This is Medieval Death Trip for Sunday, February 9th, 2025, episode 112, concerning the murder and miracles of Kenelm of Mercia. Hello and welcome to Medieval Death Trip, the show where we explore the wit and weirdness of medieval texts. I'm your host, Patrick Lane. Today, we welcome the turning of the year by picking up a dangling thread from our past little run of loosely linked episodes. Back in episode 107, we returned to the Melrose Chronicle and heard some bad weather portents of some bloody events. And in the following episodes, we heard prophecies, pondered prodigies, and examined monsters. And last episode, William of Malmesbury walked us through the saintly histories of some Anglo-Saxon nobles, including the Mercian prince Kenelm, son of King Kenulf, who fell victim to a murderous plot by his ambitious sister. William gave us the abridged version of the legend of St. Kenelm, but there are enough interesting features to it that I think it's worth extending the narrative with a different source. A more comprehensive life of St. Kenelm, composed likely in the mid-11th century, can be found preserved in several manuscripts, with some variations and degrees of abridgment. We'll be hearing a translation of the copy preserved in Bodleian Library Manuscript Deuce 368, produced in the second quarter of the 12th century, and one of the most complete surviving versions. The main text filling this particular manuscript is the Venerable Bede's Historia Ecclesiastica, but the life of Kenelm has been attached at the end, which suggests that this manuscript was made for Winchcombe Abbey in Gloucestershire, since Kenelm was the abbey's patron saint. Also, we know the manuscript ended up there for some time, since there's essentially an ex libris label inside it, stating that this book belongs to Winchcombe Abbey. Some other interesting trivia, interesting to me anyway, is that the next main thing we know about the history of this book is that it was sold in 1721 by barrister and book collector Thomas Rawlinson to someone named West for £4, or about £700 in today's money. A few decades later, it was purchased at another auction by Francis Deuce for £1.1, so a comparatively good bargain. Deuce's book collection was bequeathed to the Bodleian Library at Oxford University in 1834, where it has remained ever since. It's easy to develop a kind of stagnant view of the lives of these manuscripts, picturing them just sitting perpetually in a university or cathedral library. But most of them have changed hands many times, especially between the dissolution of the monasteries and the development of modern civic and academic libraries in the 18th century. And plenty also changed hands and changed bindings and other things throughout the Middle Ages themselves. They're a different kind of artifact than a pot or a sarcophagus that went into the ground thousands of years ago and then was dug up less than 100 years ago and put more or less directly into a museum. These books have had to pass through the wear and tear of human possession and politics and accidents and everything else. They actually have their own narratives. And those narratives, as best as we can reconstruct them, are recorded in descriptive manuscript catalogs, which I've sometimes threatened to do an episode reading from. And maybe 2025 is at last the year for it, but not quite today. We don't need much table setting for this story, especially since we've already heard the back-of-the-book synopsis of it from William of Malmesbury. But it is an opportunity to briefly touch on its setting, the Kingdom of Mercia in the 9th century. Mercia, or Mercia, you'll find credible people using both pronunciations. Mercia was located right in the middle of Great Britain, encompassing the modern Midlands. Its name is the anglicization of the Latinization of the Old English Mercna Richa, meaning Kingdom of the Border Folk. This same root, merc, gives us march, as in the Welsh marches, a borderlands region, and is unrelated to marching with your feet. There's some debate over precisely which border is being indicated by this name, but given that Mercia has nearly all the other major regions of Britain on its four sides, Wales to the west, Northumbria to the north, Wessex and the south to the south, and East Anglia and Essex to the east, wherever you were, Mercia has a good chance of being on one of your borders. Of the seven kingdoms founded by the Germanic tribes who conquered the Romanized Britons in the 5th century, it was the last to be Christianized. It enjoyed a period of political dominance in the 7th and 8th centuries, known as the Mercian Supremacy, kicked off by the defeat of the Northumbrian kings by the infamous pagan Penda, infamous at least from the eyes of monastic chroniclers. Penda's campaign included the slaying of the saintly Oswald, as we heard in episode 96, concerning the relics and grave of King Oswald. After Penda's death in 655, there are some significant hiccups in the supremacy until the Mercian throne is taken by Athelbald in 716. Indeed, many historians don't include Penda's reign in the actual Mercian supremacy, opting to start it with Athelbald, or even with his successor, Offa, perhaps the most powerful Anglo-Saxon king before Alfred the Great. Offa wears the crown for nearly 40 years, from 757 to 796, and the generation following him produces the major players in the legend of St. Kenelm. Offa was succeeded by his son Egfrith, who died of illness a mere 5 months into his reign, after which a rather distant relation, you have to go all the way back to the family of Penda to find the common link, this cousin, Kenwulf, becomes king. Apparently, according to contemporary witness Alcuin of York, the reason for having to look so far afield for a successor is because Offa had worked hard to eliminate the closer rivals for his son's throne, as also stated last episode by William of Malmesbury, who further credits Offa with the assassination of King Athelbald, though modern historians are less certain about who or what led Athelbald's own bodyguards to murder him. But the main point here is that we're in a period where the royal genealogy of Mercia is especially bloodstained. Anyway, Kenwulf has a daughter and a son. Historically, and in their Anglo-Saxon spellings, these are Quinthrith and Cunhelm, who in the legendary material are Latinized into Quindrida and Kenelm. We'll come back to the historical realities of these people after the text, but, spoilers, what facts we do know about them do not match up with the details of the legend. Our narrative kicks off with Kenwulf's death in 821, which also marks the beginning of the end of the Mercian supremacy. It's over a mere 4 years later when Mercia's loss at the Battle of Ellendun tipped the balance of power towards the Kingdom of Wessex. That all happens after our tale for today, of course, but even while playing fast and loose with historical details, our legend's author most likely would have had some notion of clouds being on the horizon for this particular dynasty. Who that author was is unknown, but there was an author at some point. This legend, or Life of St. Kenelm, is a set text that we find being copied across our various manuscripts in edited versions. It's not just a traditional narrative that each author is writing their own version of, like we had with the Green Children of Woolpit in episode 110, where Ralph of Cogshall and William of Newburgh show no signs of knowing each other's text or any common source beyond people just spreading the story. To wrap up our table setting about the tales setting, more specifically than just Mercia, this central event of the story occurs in a forest in the Clint Hills, a spot about 10 miles southwest of Birmingham. Time-wise, as I mentioned, we start with the death of King Kenulf. Now, our hagiographer here opens by saying that King Kenulf died in the year 819, which is the year given in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, but the Chronicle is off by 2 years for most of its 8th and 9th century items. But this error does show us that our hagiographer was probably using the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle for some of their historical information, which is a point we'll come back to later. And here is the legend, as preserved in Deuce 368 and translated by Clint historian John Amphlett. I'll be using the Latin-derived forms and pronunciations of the Anglo-Saxon names throughout, as that is how Amphlett has rendered them. When Kenulf died in 819, he left as his heir Kenelm, his son, who had two sisters, Quindrida and Berginhilda. Kenelm was endowed with every grace of body and mind, and, in right of his birth and by his father's will, was chosen by the people to be their king. But Quindrida, moved by a strong desire to reign herself, plotted against him, and since poison had no effect, bribed Ascobert, his guardian, to kill him, by the offer of great rewards and the hope of sharing the throne with her. About this time, Kenelm had a dream, which he told to his nurse, Wiwina, who lived at Winchcombe. "I saw," he said, "our dearest mother, a tree that reached to the stars standing by my bed, and I stood on the top of it, whence I could see all things. It was most beautiful, having wide-spreading branches, and it was covered from top to bottom with all kinds of flowers and glowed with innumerable lights. But as I wondered at the sight, some of my people cut down the tree, and it fell with a great crash, and forthwith I made for myself white wings and flew up to heaven. "Alas," said the nurse as he spoke, "my sweetest son, whom I have nourished with my milk, I fear that the falling tree means the destruction of your life through the wicked plot of your sister and the treachery of your guardian, and by the bird which went up to heaven is meant the glory of the ascension of your soul." But the child had no fear, and when at length Ascobert, seizing a chance of carrying out his crime, took him into a wood as if to hunt, the child followed like a lamb to the slaughter to reach the crown of glory. When they had come near to the wood, the tender child, being about 7 years old, became very tired and got down from his horse and, as if secure from evil, fell fast asleep while his cruel guardian dug a grave in which he might quickly hide him. When he awoke, with prophetic mind, he said, "It is vain that you have dug for me this grave. I shall not rest here, but in a far distant place which God has provided for me. And this shall be a sign, for this stick," he carried a stick, "when I plant it in the ground, shall burst into leaf." This did happen, and to this day a vast ash tree is shown which bears the memory of the holy kennel. But the cruel butcher slew him and put him in the hole he had dug, where there is a deep valley hidden between two hills in the wood called Clint. Here, under a thorn, Kenelm's head was cut off after he had said in our Lord's words, "What thou doest, do quickly." And straightway a white dove with golden wings flew up to the sky, as in the vision had been shown. They say that as he was about to be beheaded, he sang the hymn, "We praise thee, O God." And when he had come to the words, "The white-robed army of martyrs," he fell slain. Though the murderer thought he could hide his crime in that great wilderness, a shining column of light was often seen over Kenelm's body. Moreover, a white cow, leaving the pastures on the hills, went and stayed by the place and could not be taken from it. And as often as the herd grazed near the spot, they gave a double supply of milk, so wholesome was the herbage there. Moreover, what was eaten in the evening had grown more abundantly the next morning, so the place came to be called Cowvale. Quindrida, having obtained the kingdom at the price of her brother's blood, ordered that anyone who should seek for him, or even name him, should be at once beheaded. But even dumb animals spoke, and the light that was quenched in England burned more brightly at Rome. For while Pope Leo Jr. was celebrating Mass before a great crowd of people, behold, a dove whiter than snow appeared from above, bearing a snow-white scroll written upon in English with letters of gold, and placing it on the altar of St. Peter's, disappeared again into the height. The holy man beheld the unknown words with fear and asked those around what it might mean. There happened to be some Englishmen there, and by them the letter was interpreted as follows. In clinto vacae vali, Kenelmus regius natus, jacet sub spino capite truncatus. Or, in Clint Cow Valley, Kenelm the royal child lies under a thorn bush, deprived of his head. So the Pope sent an embassy to Wilfrid, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the bishops of England, that Kenelm, the future martyr of God, might be taken from his unworthy hiding place to the church at Winchcombe, built in honor of God. And so it was done, to all the joy of the people of Mercia and of England, and Kenelm reposed in the temple which his father had founded and endowed with kingly wealth. When the body was taken up, a sacred fountain burst out from the dry cave and flowed away in a stream, which brought health to many who drank of it. And while he was being carried out of the wood, the way was stopped by a great multitude, and numbers of blind and deaf and halt were healed. While the body was being borne along by the people of the province of Gloucester, an armed body of the people of the province of Worcester came up, and at the ford called Pierford, tried to stop the carrying away of the precious treasure. While the dispute was going on, it was agreed that the people who woke earliest at dawn of the next day should have the body. And it happened that the men of Gloucester were the more wakeful, and had gone 5 miles before the Worcester men arose. Moved by anger, they followed with all the speed possible, and when the fugitives saw them close at hand, calling on Kenelm, they rushed panting along a narrow path under some protecting foliage. They had come in sight of the Abbey of Winchcombe, when, overpowered by thirst and labor, they sank breathless on the sacred turf, and forthwith a spring burst out from under a neighboring stone, of which the assembly drank. And regaining strength, they went on their way, and the spring of water still flows down into the river. Quendrida was standing in the upper part of the western end of St. Peter's Church, and when she saw the multitude running down the hill, she seized a psalter and began to sing backwards the 108th psalm from the end to the beginning, so that it should be perverted from his good to his ill. But her malice was turned against herself, for when she had reached from the end of the verse, "Let this be the reward of my adversaries," her two eyes fell from their orbits onto the page she was reading. And the psalter still exists and is marked with the gore of the fallen orbs. A short time after this, the wretched woman died, and they say that neither church nor churchyard nor field would hold her when buried, but by the order of a shining angel child, she was thrown into a deep, far distant ditch. Thus the martyr Kenelm was born to his father's monastery of Winchcombe. Here his sanctity was shown by many miracles then and thereafter down to the present time. When Canute was king, a wealthy Dane, whose name was Osgot, strove to take possession of a piece of ground next to the land of the Holy Kenelm at Newington, to join his land at Ruddington. When the assembly had come together, Godwin, who was then abbot, brought the Holy Kenelm into the midst, and ordered the man, with 24 of his peers, to swear upon the body of the martyr. And as he advanced to take the oath, struck by the manifest power of God, he went backwards and fell prone along the ground. So he was led home, and not long after died. And because he had unjustly endeavored to seize a small possession, he lost all his property. A certain well-known man, named Godric, swore by the Holy Kenelm that he had never defrauded anyone of a single farthing, and he suddenly became dumb, and by his silence betrayed his guilt. At that time, the abbot had decreed that the Feast of Kenelm should be celebrated in Paleton by the staying of all work. But the lady of the manor, hearing of it when she reclined at meat, ordered no work to be stopped. She said, "I don't know why we should lose a day's work for Kenelm." But no sooner had she spoken than her eyes fell out upon the table. Moreover, her oxen, which she had yoked to the wain, shook off the yoke and disappeared, and could no more be found. It is widely known in Hereford that a hammer and pincers stuck to the right and left hands of a smith who worked on the same day, and they could not be loosened even with wedges. But when he had called upon Kenelm, the hardened hands, with the nails forced into the flesh, were restored whole. Again, on Kenelm's natal day, when the whole of England was celebrating his feast, a man born blind, by name Livesey, asked grace of the martyr. He, falling into a trance, cried out, "O holy Kenelm, spare me, why do you torment me?" Afterward, he said that he saw a most glorious boy stand by him, carrying in his hands two glowing stars which he placed on his eyes. At once his eyes were restored, and he wondered at the brightness of the day and the size of the world. For this, Abbot Godwin gave praise to God. In the same way, there came the dog keeper, who was the companion of the huntsman belonging to Alfric, a great man who dwelt in the town at Stirtle. In a trance he saw a glorious child coming to him with a burning coal, which he put on his mouth, and immediately he could speak. His master, who had known him from a child, said he had never before spoken, and the dogs obeyed the sound of his lips, though it was not formed into words. Another dumb man, who came to the steps of the presbytery as if out of his mind and was being cast about hither and thither, miserably invoked Kenelm to pity him. And the return of his speech in the presence of the aforesaid abbot and the crowd of priests and people caused all to praise God. And when he was questioned by the abbot, he said that he felt and knew nothing but that his speech returned. A certain man came crawling on the ground, who had hollowed blocks of wood bound to his knees like shoes, and wooden greaves on his thighs, and he supported his hands with sticks, being more like a reptile than one who should be able to gaze up into heaven. He had bowed himself before Kenelm for a whole day, and giving up hope, prepared to go away, when a sudden miracle happened. His strings were broken, the wooden shells shaken off, and the man rose up erect, and all sang a hymn of praise to the Lord. At another time, a certain Saxon, bound round his midst with iron, had for 15 days anticipated Kenelm's natal feast, hoping for pardon, and as the day came near, was more instant in watching and prayer. As the feast day drew on to dark, giving up hope, he prepared to depart in the morning. But as he bewailed himself, forthwith the iron band was broken, and he fell down in grateful thanks. In the next village of Southam, a father brought his son and laid him down before the altar of Kinnome. His heels were fixed to his thighs, and his hands were stuck to his sides, so that he could only move from his place by being carried. But while the abbot who succeeded Godric was beginning the evening hymn, the boy stood on his feet, and in the sight of all, stretched out his hands in grateful praise. In the past year, it seemed good to the abbot that the holy Kinnome should be borne to the place of his passion. While they were lodging in the vill of Wick, the son of Osburn, a well-known man, had the pupils of his eyes turned up under his eyebrows and hidden like stars under a cloud. So he prayed to the holy Kinnome, and each of his eyes turned to its right direction, and he enjoyed the blessing of light. On the same night, when all were overcome by sleep, a candle that burnt on the altar opposite the saint fell from its candlestick and burnt for a long time on the altar coverings as if it had been upon a dry stone. And when the monks arose and rushed to repair their negligence, they found the ash of the candle a cubit in length, showing where it had burnt. But when the ash was removed, they found that neither mark of burning nor spot of wax remained. Who could keep silence in view of such a mark of the favor of God to the blessed martyr? When he had been brought to Clint, the place was celebrated by a third miracle, for a girl bowed to the ground stood erect by the grace of God. A certain man was a cripple from his birth, so that his heels were pressed to his thighs and his fingers were turned back and stuck to his arms. His brother had taken him to many churches and with great labor had reached Rome. He was told in a dream to return to his country and go to Winchcombe, when his brother would be healed by the blessed Kinnome. So he brought his brother and laid him before the altar. And the cripple in his sleep, as he afterward said, saw a precious boy come down from the altar with a golden rod in his hand, with which he touched him and told him to rise. Then the man who had never moved except with the help of others rose and stretched forth his hands as if to embrace his Savior. But after he had touched him with the rod, the boy seemed quickly to reascend the altar and to enter the shrine which held his holy bones. And the man remained here for many years, showing the marks on his thighs where his heels had been fixed. Since present miracles, as well as past, rejoice the lovers of truth, let this writing record what has recently happened, for the voice passes away, but writing illumines those that come after. So, in the year 1149, when the monastery and all the building had been burned and reduced to ashes, the neighbors took counsel with the bishops, the abbot, and other wise men as to rebuilding it. And at length it seemed good to the prelate that two or three monks, with the body of Blessed Kinnome, should journey through the neighboring provinces, carrying with them a letter from the Bishop of Worcester and others of the province, stating the need in which the Church of the Blessed Martyr lay. The journey of the monks being prepared, and the peregrination of Kinnome being begun, the most holy body received hospitality at Leicester. Here God worked a most wonderful miracle of healing in answer to the supplications of the infirm. Among them were two youths who had come to extreme want, so the bystanders said, on account of their very great infirmity. But when they had tasted the holy water in which the relics of the saint had been dipped, they at once received help from our Lord Jesus Christ. So, there breaks off our narrative of the life and miracles of St. Kinnome. Our translator, Amphlett, notes that, quote, "Here the manuscript suddenly ends, though probably only the last leaf is wanting," end quote. We don't get full details on this last miracle, perhaps, but I think we get the picture. And the author of the catalog description of Deuce 368 suggests that this last miracle is a later addition to the received text anyway. I haven't been able to consult any of the seven other supposedly complete copies of The Legend of St. Kinnome to see how they end and what features are unique to our Winchcombe Abbey copy. Before we get to the main characters of the legend, I do just want to briefly pause to point out an interesting feature of the miracle collections attached to these kinds of legends. They are one of the main places we find clear representations of disability in medieval documents. And this one provides some particularly vivid descriptions of how medieval people managed disability, such as the man who creates wooden knee pads and crutches to move around without full use of his legs, or the way the huntsman's dog keeper, though mute, was still able to issue commands to his dogs via distinct nonverbal utterances. It gives us a little window into these medieval lives, and even if one is skeptical of the precise narrative of the miracle cures, there's little reason to think that these details aren't still drawn from life. Now, this legend is actually rubriced in the manuscript as a passio, a passion, a holy suffering story, and Kenelm is presented as a martyr, which stretches the traditional definition of a martyr a bit. He's not killed because of his faith. You could maybe say he turns the moment of his death into an act of testifying to his faith, but barely. And as for that, the historical verite of the narrative breaks down a bit at that point, since there's no one to witness these final moments other than the murderer, so who passed this information along? The historian David Rawlison has examined the cults of murdered Anglo-Saxon royals and has a theory for why these figures are presented as martyrs. When we talk about it now, the idea of sacred kingship tends to get subsumed into the development of the divine right of kings and absolute monarchies, which is primarily an early modern development, and in medieval studies we often emphasize, and maybe overemphasize, the more limited and negotiated nature of most medieval monarchies. But, particularly in the middle of the Anglo-Saxon period, we do see a lot of rhetoric around the sanctity of kinghood. You see it in Beowulf, with Grendel not daring to approach Hrothgar's seat because of the power of God. And, as Rawlison points out, you see it historically in a canon passed by papal legates visiting Britain in 786, and which states, in part, as translated by Dorothy Whitlock, quote, "Let no one dare to conspire to kill a king, for he is the Lord's anointed. And if anyone take part in such a crime, if he be a bishop or any one of the priestly order, let him be expelled from it and cast out from the holy heritage, just as Judas was ejected from the apostolic order. And everyone who has consented to such sacrilege shall perish in the eternal fetters of anathema, and, associated with Judas the betrayer, be burnt in the eternal fires. As it is written, not only they that do such things, but they also that consent to them that do them, escape not the judgment of God. For it has often been proved by examples among you that those who have been the cause of the slaying of sovereigns ended their lives in a brief space and were cut off from divine and secular rights." End quote. So, the Anglo-Saxon royal families have both an incentive and a license to promulgate the idea that kings and their rightful blood are sacred and that regicide is an act of sacrilege, and thus that murdered kings and princes are saintly martyrs. Furthermore, in moments of dynastic turnover and turmoil, such as follow an assassination, there is a lot of propaganda value in canonizing the victim and demonizing the guilty partisans. Although our 12th century manuscript's text for the Kenelm legend was likely composed in the mid-11th century, we know that some cult of St. Kenelm really did exist earlier, since his feast day begins to appear on calendars in the late 900s. Still about a century and a half after his lifetime, but at least we know that his sainthood wasn't invented out of whole cloth in the 1100s. We also know historically that there was a Kenelm, son of Kenwulf, who is documented as witness to charters during his father's reign, specifically between the years 803 and 811. Now, the legend says he died in 821 as a 7-year-old, so that doesn't line up. And we have another wrench in the works, a papal letter from 798 that states that royal heir Kenelm of Mercia was 12 years old at that time, which would make him closer to 35 when and if he's murdered in 821. Additionally, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle for the year 819, remember, the Chronicle's dates are 2 years off, the Chronicle simply says, quote, "This year Kenwulf, king of the Mercians, died, and Ceolwulf succeeded to the kingdom. And Eadbrict, the alderman, died." End quote. Then, for 821, it says, quote, "This year, Ceolwulf was deprived of his kingdom." End quote. That's it. You have to get to the entry for 823 to be informed that Bjornwulf became king of the Mercians next. The main point here is that Kenelm and Quinthrith are not at all mentioned in the succession details of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Now, that doesn't rule out the possibility of a royal murder plot, The Chronicle is frequently short on detail, but it certainly doesn't help the case for tying the legend to real history. The fact that Kenwulf's brother got his throne does suggest something must have happened to the son, but the evidence of the charters alone tells us that he must have lived to be a teenager at least, so even if he fell afoul of a murder plot, or even a hunting accident later reimagined as a murder plot, it was not as an innocent child martyr. There are two particularly plausible scenarios for the origin of the Kenelm legend. One is that Kenelm does die, maybe suspiciously, as a young man. As a royal who died too soon, a little cult develops around him, as we see happening often enough, and a century on, this Saint Kenelm gets assimilated with royal child martyrs, which William of Malmesbury already showed us there were plenty of stories about. So the young man is re-envisioned as a child. The other scenario is kind of the same thing, but backwards. Perhaps there was an existing local cult of a child martyr, and at some point the name and dynastic legacy of Kenelm gets attached to it. Both possibilities point to how this legend might have drifted towards a generic template of a murdered prince's saint's life. If you've been listening to the show for a while, you probably had a bit of déjà vu listening to this legend, and not just because we heard the abridged version last episode. We have the same column of light revealing the murdered child's body that we saw with the story of William of Norwich, as well as Wisden last episode. William of Malmesbury also gave us an animal standing vigil over the remains of the saint, a wolf guarding Edmund's head in that case, and here we have a cow marking out Kenelm's burial spot. The breaking of the iron band around the penitent Saxon echoes the story of the bands of Philip de Bella Arbore, loosed apparently by little William of Norwich, as we discussed way back in episode 28. We also have seen miraculous fountains associated with saints and their shrines a number of times, and that's an image that goes all the way back to Moses. One other legendary element I want to look at more closely is the fate of Kenelm's sister, Quindrida. First of all, let's talk about the bit of magic she employs here, reading a psalm backwards. William of Malmesbury includes this detail, stating that she did this, quote, "for I know not what charm," end quote. The author of our legend is not so confused, specifying that she read the psalm backward, quote, "so that it should be perverted from his good to his ill," end quote. I struggle to find a comprehensive source specifically addressing the practice of reading or reciting backwards in the Middle Ages, but a number of little brief references to it suggest two influences. One is echoes of Kabbalistic practices of rendering text backwards or making sacred palindromes and things like that, which may have spilled over into learned conceptions of witchcraft. The other, and to me, much more likely influence, is found as a cross-cultural principle of folk magic, that doing something backwards undoes it or inverts it. The best description I found of this is from an article about witchcraft in North Carolina by Tom Pete Cross. He writes, quote, "A considerable number of witch spells and countercharms are justified by the widespread popular belief that reversal in process involves reversal in result. If doing a thing one way works good, doing it the opposite way produces evil. Thus, Christian symbols and formulae, so often employed against witchcraft, are used in reverse order by the witches themselves. For example, in Alabama, witches conjure by saying the Lord's Prayer backwards. On the eastern shore of Maryland, reading the Bible forwards very properly prevents injury from ghosts after they have got into the house, but, strange to say, reading it backwards prevents them from entering." End quote. Cross gives some other protective reversals to undo charms or ghostly threats, including walking backwards and wearing clothes inside out. So, sometimes you play your heavy metal record backward to summon the devil, and sometimes you do things backward to confound the spirits. Consistency is not exactly a core principle of folk magic, but the negative version of reversals definitely is on display in our legend. Presumably, there really was a psalter with suggestive stains on it held at St. Peter's in Winchcombe, which was used to reinforce this story, but as with Kenelm, there's not much historical documentation to support this version of Quindrida or Quinthrith. She is in the records as Kenwulf's daughter, who went on to become the abbess of the double monastery of Winchcombe, meaning it had both a community of nuns and one of monks. and we know from records that she was involved in a dispute over ecclesiastical privileges with the Archbishop of Canterbury from 825 to 827. So if her eyes did fall out of her head, she did not die quite as shortly thereafter as the legend indicates. What some scholars think is more likely is that the misogynist ill will generated by this fight with the Archbishop led to Quinthrith being cast as the villain in the legend. Also, the whole premise of Quinthrith being able to seize the throne after her brother's death doesn't really jibe with the real historical circumstances. On balance, Rollason classes the legend of St. Kenelm as, quote, hagiographical fabrication, end quote, though he allows that, quote, some earlier material, however garbled, may have lain behind it, end quote. And speaking of historical fiction, I should also mention for fans of the show Vikings that the character Quinthrith on the show is based in part on this Quinthrith. I must confess that I haven't gotten around to watching Vikings yet myself, so I have nothing else to add. What I do have to add as a final note to this legend is a look at a peculiar custom once celebrated on St. Kenelm's Day, July 17th, in Clint, called crabbing the parson. Here is an account of this local tradition from John Brand and Sir Henry Ellis's 1859 book, Observations on the Popular Antiquities of Great Britain, chiefly illustrating the origin of our vulgar and provincial customs, ceremonies, and superstitions. The background music here is a piece also composed in 1859 by Joachim Raff, the third of his six morceaux, as performed on organ by Benjamin Intertaglia. A very curious custom was formerly practiced at Clint in the parish of Hales Owen, County Salop. A fair was wont to be held in the field in which St. Kenelm's Chapel is situate. It is of very ancient date, and probably arose from the congregating together of numbers of persons to visit the shrine of St. Kenelm on the feast of the saint, 17th of July. By the 33rd year of Henry VIII, the fair, or rather, we presume, the tolls of the fair, were granted to Roger de Summery, the Lord of Clint. The article of cheese was the principal commodity brought for sale, till, about a quarter of a century ago, the fair was numbered amongst the bygones. Clint was royal demesne and still enjoys peculiar privileges. The inhabitants are free from serving on juries at assizes and sessions, and also of tolls throughout the kingdom. And at St. Kenelm's Fair, and also at the Fair of Holy Cross in the parish of Clint, the inhabitants sold ale and other refreshments without license or the intervention of the gauger, by an old charter which was granted by Edward the Confessor and confirmed by Elizabeth. St. Kenelm's Wake is held, or rather used to be held, for 'tis now but little noticed, on the Sunday after the fair, on which day, within the recollection of numbers of persons now living, it was the annual practice to crab the parson. The last clergyman but one who was subjected to this process was a somewhat eccentric gentleman named Lee. He had been chaplain to a man of war, and was a jovial old fellow in his way, who could enter into the spirit of the thing. My informant well recollects the worthy divine, after partaking of dinner at the solitary house near the church, quietly quitting the table when the time for performing the service drew nigh, and reconnoitering the angles of the building, and each buttress and coign of vantage behind which it was reasonable to suppose the enemy would be posted, and watching for a favorable opportunity, he would start forth at his best walking pace. He scorned to run, to reach the church. Around him, thick and fast, fell from ready hands a shower of crabs, not a few telling with fearful emphasis on his burly person amid the intense merriment of the rustic assailants. But the distance is small. He reaches the old Saxon porch, and the storm is over. Another informant, a man of Clint, states that he has seen the late incumbent, the Reverend John Todd, frequently run the gauntlet, and that on one occasion there were two sacks of crabs, each containing at least three bushels, emptied into the church field, besides large store of other missiles provided by other parties. And it also appears that some of the more wanton not unfrequently threw sticks, stakes, etc., which probably led to the suppression of the practice. The custom of crabbing the parson is said to have arisen on this wise. Long, long ago, an incumbent of Frankley, to which St. Kenelm's is attached, was accustomed, through horrid, deep-rutted, miry roads, occasionally to wend his way to the sequestered depository of the remains of the murdered Saint King, to perform divine service. It was his wont to carry creature comforts with him, which he discussed at a lone farmhouse near the scene of his pastoral duties. On one occasion, Whether the pastor's wallet was badly furnished or his stomach more than usually keen, tradition saith not, but having eaten up his own provision, he was tempted, after he had donned his sacerdotal habit and in the absence of the good dame, to pry into the secrets of a huge pot in which was simmering the savory dinner the lady had provided for her household. Among the rest, dumplings formed no inconsiderable portion of the contents. The story runs that our parson poached sundry of them, hissing hot, from the cauldron, and hearing the footsteps of his hostess, he, with great dexterity, deposited them in the ample sleeves of his surplice. She, however, was conscious of her loss, and closely following the parson to the church, by her presence prevented him from disposing of them, and, to avoid her accusation, he forthwith entered the reading desk and began to read the service, the clerk beneath making the responses. Ere long, a dumpling slips out of the parson's sleeve and falls on Sleek John's head. He looked up with astonishment, but took the matter in good part and proceeded with the service. By and by, however, John's pate receives a second visitation, to which he, with upturned eyes and ready tongue, responded, "Two can play at that, master," and suiting the action to the word, he forthwith began pelting the parson with crabs, a store of which he had gathered, intending to take them home in his pocket to foment the sprained leg of his jade of a horse. And so well did the clerk play his part that the parson soon decamped amid the jeers of the old dame and the laughter of the few persons who were in attendance. And in commemoration of this event, so saith the legend, crabbing the parson has been practiced on the Wake Sunday from that time till a very recent period. This very singular custom is alluded to in the Gentleman's Magazine for September 1797, page 738. Quote, "At the wake held there, called Kenelm's Wake, alias Crab Wake, the inhabitants have a singular custom of pelting each other with crabs, and even the clergyman seldom escapes as he goes to or comes from the chapel." End quote. It would seem from this that the clergyman was not the only object of attack. Now, I hate to rob this scene of its magic for any of you who might be picturing a volley of crustaceans flying at the poor clergyman, but crabs here means crab apples, a rather less outlandish form of missile for a nonetheless rather outlandish custom. Interestingly, the origins of the word crabapple are obscure and largely unknown. It might come from Norse roots. A Swedish dialect word, skraba, is recorded for wild apples, and that seems to underlie a Scots word, scrab, and that form could well have migrated south, losing its S to become crab. In that form, it would then semantically link up with crab and crabby, meaning perverse, contrary, or cantankerous. A crabapple looks fine on the outside, but conceals an unappetizingly tart interior. Or crabby things can also be crooked or gnarled, and it may connect more to the branches of the wild apple tree. Either way, that form of crab comes from the crustacean, based on how crabs scuttle sideways, making them seem perverse or crooked in one way or another. They're also pinchy, which helps reinforce the mean-tempered kind of crabby, and maybe hints towards the bite and tartness of the fruit. Our riddle this episode is one of the claret riddles. It is, "She's leaving town now and tossing cakes behind her." So, what does that image describe? The answer, as given in the text, is a sight one may have seen in Clint Cowback. It is, "The cow is dropping dung as she makes her way out of town." The Latin word translated as cakes in the riddle is tortas, which did mean flat cake in late Latin, or round bread. It is what both tort, as in the dessert, and tortilla, little round bread, derive from. And here, it's operating in the same metaphorical mode as modern English cowpat, or cowpatty, or cowpie. Cowpat traces back to the 1850s and seems to be a variant on cowpad, which is recorded as early as 1736. The other two forms, cowpatty and the North American cowpie, both appear to be 20th century developments, at least in print usage. But apparently, people have been comparing cow droppings to baked goods since at least the mid-1300s, as this claret riddle shows. We'll be back next episode with a mystery word. If you'd like to get the mystery words and riddles before their episodes, we put those out on our social media. All those account names can be found on the homepage of our website, medievaldeathtrip.com, where you can also find bibliographic references for every episode. You can also reach me by email there to patrick@medievaldeathtrip.com. You can also support the show via Patreon, which will give you access to bonus audio content, such as an appendix to last episode, a reading of a medical journal article from 1912 called Origins of Medical Monstrosities. I'd like to thank our recent new, returning, and upgrading patrons, so thank you Kyle, David, Libby, and John. Your support really does help the show out, especially with a number of annual service subscriptions, like my access to the Oxford English Dictionary that renewed at the start of the year. So without you, I would not have been able to enlighten everyone as to the origins of crabapples and cowpats. So again, thank you. Anyone else who would like to support the show can do so at patreon.com/mdtpodcast. And so, until next time, remember that if you're ever reading backwards, be sure to hold your eyes in your head. And thanks for listening.